We want to thank y'all for tuning in to Running Up the Numbers.
Every Monday at 8 a.m. And if you miss us in the morning, you can catch the replay in the afternoon at 2 p.m. and again at 8 p.m. You can also catch the shows archived over at thenumbers.fm. You can also catch us every morning at 6 a.m. on 107.1 xray.fm.
Make sure you're following us on all social media, because we out here. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, House Party, YouTube, Twitch, Black Planet, because we never left, MySpace, Tinder, and Google Plus.
And in this episode, we'll be putting you up on the CNN crew getting arrested on live TV. We also have an interview with Phil Roundtree, the founder of Quantify, around mental health and the current state of the world.
The latest update to unemployment benefits and the Portland Rebellion in response to the George Floyd murder.
Then we got Lil Fo5, a.k.a. Donald, tweeting threats towards protesters in Minneapolis. Looting will lead to shooting, says 4-5. 45, also known as Ronald McDonald, took to Twitter in response to the widespread protests happening in Minneapolis. In a tweet violating Twitter's rules against glorifying violence, 4-5 said, "These thugs, all caps, are dishonoring the memory of George Floyd, and I won't let that happen. Just spoke to Governor Tim Walz and told him that the military is with him all the way. Any difficulty and we will assume control, but when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Thank you." This tweet was made following another which threatened to send in the National Guard, and Twitter stepped in and affixed a warning label to both, marking the first time such action has been taken against the accounts, official White House, a.k.a. Donald Trump's personal feelings account. This also added to a growing tension between the Orange and Twitter after he signed an executive order that purportedly addressed censorship by Twitter and other social media companies, following Twitter's earlier decision to affix fact-check type labels to two of his misleading posts about mail-in voting ballots.
Man, I'm glad it finally happened. Twitter has been very slow on this. He has been violating those terms for a minute now. Like, we've seen him close people's accounts for less. And, I mean, I just feel like him on Twitter is super reckless anyway. Remember, there was a point we were, like, close to war because he's popping off fly on Twitter. And I'm like, y'all need to cut him off. He's inciting war. Like, cut him off, yo. Like, straight up. We can't have him out here with no filter. Seriously.
0%. So I'm glad Twitter is definitely getting on the ball. They've drawn their line in the sand, it seems.
Yeah. Up next, we have federal unemployment benefits discontinued to employees who decline to return to their place of employment after the offer is made to return. While states around the nation are starting to revive, not everyone is prepared to go back to work. Numerous workers are feeling uneasy about returning to their jobs in the middle of COVID-19 and would prefer to receive benefits from state unemployment than to jeopardize their well-being. Reporting from the Wall Street Journal discovered that half of the workers who were laid off received increased monetary benefits from unemployment than from their last job due to federal guide extensions to those qualified, gifting them in excess of $600 every month. Many employees may find themselves in an unfortunate situation as states permit organizations to reopen. Managers who extend unemployment to those whose jobs had ceased due to the pandemic, and if those people decline a return to work, they will not be able to continue to collect federal unemployment assistance and will be deemed ineligible. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin told the Senate Banking Committee on Tuesday, "In the event that you offer an individual a job and that individual doesn't take the job, then that individual would not be permitted to receive federal assistance." He said the organizations that obtain credits from the Paycheck Protection Program must let the state assistant offices know when they make offers to rehire individuals who lost their positions. So we kind of saw this coming. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the game. That, it's going to come down to that individual choice. Do you feel safe to return to work after all these, restrictions are lifted? And I think that's something that people aren't taking into consideration. Like, y'all want outside to open back up, but do you really feel safe outside? Or is just you want outside to open back up because you're missing a couple things here and there? There are far-reaching implications to rolling back all these restrictions because now it's on you. If your job is saying, "All right, we back open." It's not like just the clubs open back up and you don't got to go to work. No. Once everything opens back up, do you feel safe going to work? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, man.
So layered.
Yes, very.
Well, we got a CNN news crew arrested live on air. CNN correspondent Omar Jimenez, his producer Bill Kirkos, and his photojournalist Leonel Mendez were reporting live in downtown Minneapolis near a police precinct that had been set on fire during the protests in response to George Floyd's death, which was filmed on video saying that he could not breathe as a white police officer used his knee to pin Floyd down. Jimenez had his CNN badge fully visible while reporting and even identified himself as a reporter while also offering to move wherever the officers needed him and his crew to be, but he was still grabbed and placed in handcuffs, all while on a live broadcast. We can move back to where you like. We are live on the air. Put us where you want us. We're getting out of your way. Wherever you want us, we'll get out of your way, Jimenez said to the police before he was led away. Jimenez, Kirkos, and Mendez were taken to the city's downtown public safety building after their arrest, but were released around 6 a.m. Central Time. Jimenez, after his release, reported live outside from downtown and said he'd been treated cordially after he'd been led away. "We're doing okay now. There were a few uneasy moments there," Jimenez said. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz told CNN Worldwide President Jeff Zucker that he deeply apologizes for what happened and would work to have the crew released. Later, after the crew was freed, Walz told reporters, "We've got to ensure that there is a safe spot for journalists to tell the story." The troopers were clearing the area at Walz's direction, he said, adding that there was absolutely no reason for the journalist's arrest and that he takes full responsibility. Minnesota State Police released a statement stating, "In the course of clearing the streets and restoring order at Lake Street and Snelling Avenue, four people were arrested by State Patrol troopers, including three members of a CNN crew. The three were released once they were confirmed to be members of the media." CNN disputed the state police characterization in a statement on Twitter. "This is not accurate. Our CNN crew identified themselves on live television immediately as journalists. We thank Minnesota at Governor Tim Walz for his swift action this morning to aid in the release of our crew."
What never ceases to amaze me is police officers' inability to tell the truth even when video evidence exists. Like, what is it in their training or just the culture that tells them it doesn't matter what's on video? We're still going to say whatever we're going to say. I think part of it, answering my own question here, I think part of it is because there is no consequence for lying.
Right.
There's just no consequence for lying at all for police officers. None. There's no discipline whatsoever. Zilch. Like, that's wild.
And not even chastising behind the scenes, you know, it's
nothing.
It's just one of those things we condemn and come down on our street criminals, not to say that they're, you know, a great asset to society, but, you know, the whole no snitching code. And it seems that the police force lives by that to the maximum.
What? They tell all of the lies, bruh.
Look.
But I guess that works. I mean, here's the thing. If you're going to penalize them for making false statements, you'd have to also penalize them for planning drugs, which we don't see too much of that happening. You know, it's case building. It's case building.
Don DeMarco, Don DeMarco. Bang, bang. Bang.
Speaking of bang, bang, Portland, the rebellion, the uprising was live. So the last couple of nights, it's been pretty active out here. I'm not sure how long this is going to go on for. I do remember the first night, I think it was earlier in the week, I saw some coverage on Coin 6, and there were some people blocking off the street outside the Justice Center. I'm like, okay, this seems like what I would expect from Portland. You know, it was about 50 people out there, and they sleeping in the street, and Black Lives Matter signs. Okay, all right, so some things cracking. But then, as things started to light up in other states, things changed here. So, I was, it might have been Friday night. I think it was Friday night. I hopped on Facebook just to hit a couple lives and see if I could check in on some people. And I ended up hopping on DJ BK. Shout out to BK. Hopping on her IG live, and she was there at one of the protests downtown. Ravina Rocket was down there too. Vina Baby, she was down there. And it was a little, man, it was chaos, man. They were running around, flash bombs going off. It was kind of wild down there. And then she also had on her live a protester getting hit at MLK and Shaver. Like, there was a dude in like a silver Golf. And he was just, he was just playing with people's lives out there. It was wild. I did do a quick breeze through MLK on the way to the station today. And Yeah, there's definitely some broken glass out there. There is spray paint. There are crews out there cleaning up. It's a little active. I saw broken glass at U.S. Bank, some shattered glass at Wells Fargo, spray painting up on Subway, some bus shelters, O'Reilly's Auto Parts. And then the reports from downtown are vicious. Mm-hmm. They ran through Target. Target is a target no matter where they are. It's almost like that's top of the uprising food chain. We got to find the targets first. Target those targets.
And then and I watched the video of them first breaking into the window. I've seen an upload of them first getting into that window and watching the swarm come from there.
So they hit the Target. They hit the Apple store. They hit the Louis V store. I'm like, the Apple store is solid glass all the way around. And I'm just like, oh, boy.
Just there was a video clip I watched from Friday night. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be Friday night, Saturday morning, because they started around midnight. And there was a guy with a sledgehammer just walking down the street casually, breaking all the windows to the jewelry stores.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So the jewelry stores were getting hit, but watching this guy just walk like it was nothing and just ching, ching, ching. In which a majority of what I saw, and almost 100%, it made sense as far as the people who were doing the damage for Portland.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, we could talk about, we're there now. We could talk about agitators. We could talk about the social justice cosplayers. There are a lot of different things happening. In Minnesota, there's footage of a police officer that was caught smashing the windows of AutoZone. He got all the way caught out there. They got his name. You know, it's out there. And then, you know, you just have some of these alt-right groups out here pretending and taking advantage of these situations to just cause havoc in the name of these peaceful protests and these peaceful organizations. But specifically here in Portland, we do have an issue with social justice cosplayers. We do have an issue with people that just want to hop up in the moment and wild out. You know, I saw a lot of interactions on Facebook among the black community. And I made a point to say, like, hey, listen, we got to stop coming down hard and chastising each other. If you actually look at this footage, these are white people out here cutting up. Like, just, you know, there's a whole mob mentality happening right now. And they just out here like it's mischief night having a ball. None of this has anything to do with George at all. Like, none of it, you know, so.
Right. Kun Love out of Seattle, shout out Kun Love. He put up a video and showed downtown Seattle and made a clear distinction between the people here protesting and then the havoc that was happening down the street. And he was like, I just want you guys to see this because this is not a part of that.
Right.
The news is going to group this together.
Right.
Just make note of this. Thought that was a great, great thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent thing. We want to be more purposeful with communicating that and just having, you know, a common understanding around, one, what riots are, two, what rebellions and uprisings are. You know what I'm saying? Because time after time, another hashtag gets put up, another, you know, black or brown body is killed by law enforcement, and every single time we're like, yo, one more time. They're going to keep messing with us. They're going to keep pushing us. It's about to go down. It was a lot of talking. Now things are happening. Now there are young people out here angry. They're fed up. And they are taking it to the system. And some of the pushback that I'm seeing them receive from people in, you know, my age bracket and the generation below was like, everybody go home. Everybody be safe. This isn't the way. And I'm like, weren't y'all the same ones that was just power to the people, Black Panther Party? Weren't y'all, you know,
Pick a side.
And here's the thing. Even within those sides, there are different flanks to the approach. You know what I'm saying? So if being out in the street and being physical isn't for you, cool.
Yeah.
Get on the phone, make some phone calls, send some emails, use your social media. But there hasn't been a revolution that existed in U.S. history that wasn't a violent one. So I don't know. Get familiar. Seriously, get familiar. Plain and simple.
Yes.
Straight up.
Up next, we have an interview with Phil Roundtree of Quartify LLC as we discuss black mental health during the mini crisis that we're currently facing.
All right, everybody. Here on Running Up the Numbers, we got a special interview today with guest Philip Roundtree, founder and CEO of Quartify LLC. And you've got Ken Jones and Ambush here handling this.
Hey, hey, hey.
How's it going, sir?
Phil, thank you so much, man.
Oh, no doubt, brothers. Thank you for having me.
So, wanted to kind of jump in. Got a couple of questions to lead into. Could you let us know what is mental wellness coaching and how does it differ from traditional therapy?
So, I mean, how can I put this? The biggest difference is that there's no insurance involved, right? So this means that people pay strictly out of pocket. And so outside of that, when we talk about just the tenets of mental wellness coaching, again, it's that idea of what therapy represents. I go to therapy. I have been in therapy now for the past 3 years, but it's something that scares people when they hear the word therapy. You know, we can talk about the cliche stigma attached to the idea of therapy, especially amongst black and brown folk. And so I didn't want to just say that I was a therapist, but I'm a coach, right? Like I'm trying to encourage you. I'm trying to push you forward while still using some of the basic tenets and skill set that I learned from being a therapist for, you know, X amount of years. But for real, man, it's just, we just argue with semantics when it comes down to it.
So you make a point to mention black mental health. What are some of the characteristics that are unique to our mental health experience?
So I think the biggest difference is the idea of trauma and the impact of trauma. Now, everybody experiences trauma, you know, across the racial and ethnic spectrum, but our trauma is something that's unique because it's been occurring for, you know, hundreds of years, right? So, you know, we're talking about historical trauma from when we were enslaved. Then we start moving forward. We go through Jim Crow. We go through the Civil Rights Movement. We go up until yesterday, you know, and what's been taking place across different cities. I live in Philly, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for those who aren't in the know of what Philly is, right? But, you know, we're seeing this tragic imagery that's been taking place. We understand the trauma when it's now not only talking about just murder and what have you, we're talking about the wealth disparity that exists amongst between black and white folk, right? Like that's traumatic and it impacts our well-being. So it's the idea of trauma being anything that adversely impacts our ability to not only live but our ability to thrive.
And I think it's important. I mean, I'm glad that you are making that distinction. I think it's very important to constantly remind people that there are some very unique experiences that affect us differently because, you know, we're talking about the black experience. So there's specific trauma that we endure on a daily basis that might not be directly tied to any huge incident. But just, you know, I was having a conversation with a friend last week and was like, I saw a cop two blocks back. My head's on a swivel, period. Just because he's in traffic, that officer is in traffic two blocks behind me.
Yeah.
You know, like,
you know,
there's a history associated.
It's interesting too, in just the way in which we carry it. And there's a certain desensitization that comes with it. And then it finds ways to rear its head in weird times. And also in weird ways. And, you know, I think about it in this context of I got a tooth injury from hooping when I was a teenager. Right. And when I went in for one of my most recent x-rays at the dentist, he talked about my tooth
like asking if I was in pain over it, and told him, no, I've never really had an issue outside of maybe that first 6 months. And he was saying that there's a good possibility that if I happen to stub my toe hard one day, my body's gotten so used to that going on in my tooth, if it went to my foot, then I would start hurting in my mouth, meaning that pain would come back because I've gotten so used to it and kind of numb to it. And I think about that and kind of the way that we move through life, just carrying the weight of stuff. And then an occurrence happens and now it all comes out.
Yeah. And I think that's why, you know, like I see all this looting. I see, granted, you know, it's not just black folk who are out here looting, no matter what the media tries to portray, or who are out here committing quote unquote violence. Like, I take those terms serious, right? So I don't just like to just use them all willy nilly.
Right.
But what's taking place for a lot of people is you're seeing the manifestation of a lot of anger, of a lot of rage, of, you know, 15 years, 20 years, 35 years in my case, 50 years of people who have been who've had to be resilient by force, right? And so they are internalizing all of their experiences. What you're talking about is the body keeping score, yes, right? And so it's this book called by some white cat, because he got a Von in his name, right? So it's a Von something, so you gotta be white. But, you know, it talks about how your body remembers everything, right? And it stores it in different places. So we're talking about it stores in your mind, it stores in your gut, right? A lot of people don't know, a lot of our emotional reactions are partially triggered by our gut, right? Because again, all this tension and everything is stored within the body. And so it has to come out. There's no way of keeping it in. At some point it will manifest itself. For some people, it's picking up a vice, it's drinking, it's drugging. For some, you know, a lot of brothers I have these conversations with, this promiscuity, right? It's going to come out in some way, and you, the only thing you hope is that it comes out in a healthy way, and not a maladaptive way that might get you killed. When we talk about black boys and black men, like our depression and anxiety doesn't necessarily manifest itself in sitting in the room in our room for 3 or 4 days, right? That happens at times. Me being somebody who lives with it, there are days where I don't feel like doing anything. I don't want to come out. I know my depression is flaring up. But a lot of other times it manifests itself through anger and rage. And so anger and rage meet somebody who's not aware, who understands and that this individual might be triggered from a past experience or just from having the experience of living with depression and anxiety. It's a combustible situation. So nah, man, you're right on point with it, where, you know, the body knows, no matter how hard we try to mask it with self-care and bubble baths and stuff, excuse me, I almost let it go. Like, that's, we have to find healthier ways to get it out.
So we got to have, I'm glad we got right here, because we have a habit of, you know, really being hard on each other, and very so often, and I find myself doing it for decades, saying, like, it's something wrong with black people, something wrong with black people. And while that may be true, there isn't enough of the follow-up conversation to talk about what is actually illing us, what is actually wrong with us. Can you talk a little bit about generational trauma, you know, as it relates specifically to the African-American experience, and having that, you know, that not just that muscle memory, but that mental, you know, experience being passed down?
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, Bell Hooks talks about the idea, she called WASP, I always mess up the acronym, whatever, but white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy that we all live in. And we all experience the effects of it. And what that looks like is just the years and decades and centuries of oppression. So again, we talk about the manifestation of it. You know, if we go back to during the slavery period, right, where black men couldn't emote, they couldn't sit and cry. Why? Because that could mean the difference between life or death. And so we look at a young fella that's walking around, who's not smiling, who's who's angry, who's not emotive. It's like, no, young fella, you got to smile. It's just like, nah, we talking about survival here, right? It's no difference than you know, 400 years ago and today, when survival is the name of the game. The space might not be safe enough for somebody to truly emote. We talking about the tension that builds up. This week on my platform, I'm going to be having a conversation with some sisters and another brother, and we're going to sit and we're going to watch James Baldwin and Nikki Giovanni conversation. And we talk about the manifestation of it. You know, she's like, listen, what you sitting here smiling in these white folk face all day, right? And then when you come home, we get the worst of you. And he's like, I got to pay the bills, right? And she's like, because I don't want you out here, you know, having to do what you got to do to pay the bills. And so we're bringing that tension to one another to where, you know, we're taking on the mindset of the oppressor, right? And so that's why we continue to see this conflict that exists among groups. We see it now, man. Like, I've gotten so much pushback on my post where I'm like, first, you know, with these, you know, with George Floyd, God bless the dead, right? Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna, all these individuals, God bless the dead. But I can't afford to get caught up in this. I can't afford to continue to expose myself to this trauma, because I'm trying to live a long life. And me getting involved, emotionally invested in every situation. Listen, black folk already have the lowest life expectancy, right? Especially black men, where the average age of death is 67 here in Philly for black men. So I can't afford to necessarily participate in this conversation. But even though I've still participated in the conversation, because if I don't, who will? But it's this idea of, it's not necessarily about black men, right? Yes, George Floyd was a black man who was, you know, killed, who was murdered by the police. But this is an attack on blackness, right? And so I see a lot of people, we need to focus on our black men. And I'm like, listen, they're killing our black women. They're killing our trans women. They're killing our trans men, right? Here in Philadelphia, the protesting is cool. Like, we protested yesterday. It was out here heavy. But I'm like, all right, George Floyd got killed by a knee to his throat. But our black boys and black girls are going to elementary schools that have asbestos, 10 and 15 schools that have asbestos, which are killing our black youth. The number one reason for black boys going into the emergency room, again, here in Philadelphia, is due to asthma, right? And so when we're talking about the war on blackness, that manifests itself across all of these situations. But we get so caught up a lot of times in the trauma Olympics, what I call it, right? Where black men got the gold medal because we're, you know, when videos come out of Christian Cooper, who, by the way, was a Karen in his own right, but that's a conversation for another day. When we talk about, you know, the Christian Coopers and the Ahmaud Arbery's and the George Floyd's, it's just like we really get galvanized when it's black men. Right. And then next we have black women who are fighting with trans women who gets the silver medal, when in reality, we all out here losing. Right. And so if we could look at it from a perspective of blackness being attacked, we'd really be able to do something. But again, that's another conversation for another day.
Yo, so speaking to, you know, these experiences and how they're passed down, my two youngest children are young ladies, and I remember having a conversation with them. It was less of a conversation, but just, I guess, part of my actions in parenting. At the time, I was a single parent back in Philly. Mm-hmm. And I remember us being in situations where they'll start crying, and I'm like, hey, shut that down. Shut that down. This ain't the moment. This ain't the time. Stop all that crying. And that came from how I was brought up, you know, and my father preparing me. And of course, we want to make sure we're, you know, creating healthier habits as we continue this journey in parenting. And it wasn't until a woman spoke to me about it later and was like, no, you got to let these babies cry, first off. Second off, you should be crying more. And initially, I was like, what are you talking, man? You better chill out. I don't got time to cry. Like, What do you mean? Like, where is the space? Where is the space and time? Where can I safely? Nah, I don't have time for that. Yeah. Nah. And it wasn't until, again, you know, experiencing so many other things and just, you know, really taking a step back and understanding some of the decisions I was making from a parenting standpoint and just, you know, for myself. But yeah, you definitely nailed that.
So something that did get touched on, just as far as, you know, seeing these videos and such pop up, I feel like there's a lot of display of black and brown bodies, black brown trauma that you don't see in other capacities. So yeah. What do you think the long-term effects of seeing harmed black and brown bodies displayed has on black and brown people viewing them?
Word. Well, first I'll take a step back, right? Because I used to be one of those people who like, yo, don't share trauma. And up until probably about a year ago, you know, they, IG and all those, they show you your memories, like, please don't repost trauma. And I've, you know, did a complete 180 on that, where, no, please show it, because some people need to see it, right? And that's you could tell somebody, yo, so-and-so got punched in their face, right? You hear about it, you know, the next day at school, like, yo, so-and-so got punched in, like, where? But when you sit in there and you actually watch it, that evokes a different emotion. And for some people, they need to see it. Me personally, I don't, right? I don't need to see it. I already saw Sean Bell, Abdul-Luim, I done saw Philando Castile. At that, I'm like, nah, I'm cool with, you know, with what they call trauma porn. You know, I don't need my entertainment to be something as traumatic as that. So, but at this point, I recognize that, yo, you got to share it. Because if you don't share it, some people not going to know, and people not going to understand the severity of it. Now, conversely, the impact of that are, again, we talk about the desensitizing of what violence is, to where I remember I was on Facebook Live. I always tell the story of some boy in Chicago. He was like, yeah, I'm on Facebook Live. Then you hear gunshots and the phone dropped. And I was just like, oh, all right. Kept scrolling. It's just like, wait, what? You just saw somebody get murdered. You just go keep scrolling? Like, that's not healthy. That there's nothing healthy about that. So we talk about the desensitization of it. And then we talk about... you know, I know nobody wants to hear about black on black crime during this time, right? But again, that's a direct response to some type of trauma, some form of trauma, to where I can't look at you as my black brother, my black sister, my black person, right? I view you through the eyes of the oppressor. And so it's impossible for me to see you that way when every image that I see is telling me that this is who you are, right? And so, you know, that's why, I have to catch myself sometimes where I might be in the environment. I see young fellas who they ain't doing nothing but being young fellas. I'm like, all right, let me put myself on guard. And unfortunately, that's it. You know, what makes me any different than the white woman who clutches up hers? Wow, because we got the same view. But I have to understand just the impact of that. Right. On my psyche and how I see people and how I see the world. And then again, we talk about the physiological impact, We talk about, you know, stress. We accumulate a lot of stress by the very nature of being black. We already feel like we 10 steps behind and we got to go 20 steps forward. Right. So we already put this pressure on ourselves. And so now it's like, we got to do it for George Floyd. We got to excel, black excellence, X, Y, and Z. Right. So we're taking all of this in. We talk about stress. The number one killer of black men is heart disease. Same thing for black women. So when we see people like Andre Harrell, who dies in his 50s, you sit back like, nah, a heart attack at 50 something ain't right. Mm-hmm. Right? It makes you want to look deeper. And then when we start looking at the hearts of these people, of John Singleton, you know, who died, you know, again, late 50s, early 60s, we see the death as a result, because why? They have high stress, which leads to strokes, which leads to heart attacks. And we're not taking care of ourselves. You know what I mean? And so, again, it impacts our relationships. It's hard. How can you have a healthy relationship with your partner, with your homies, which, you know what I mean, with people in general, if you're taking in all this unhealthy imagery, right, and hearing about all of these things. So, yeah, man, it impacts us holistically.
Do you think, because one of the points that you made in there was just talking about the young dudes, and I had a thought about that, because I definitely can identify with that. You know, I'm 35, and I look at some of it where this is what I come from. This is, you know, I think I transferred back into being that age bracket and the things that I was into, and then the environments that I was in, kind of that kicking and coming into play. So it's actually a lived experience versus, you know, something that I've been fed through the television and the media and stuff. So those responses be coming from two different places versus, you know, this white lady walking through clutching her pearls, as opposed to me being more aware because I can pick up on signs and feelings of what's going on in this neighborhood or wherever I'm at. I think we do get an extra instinct when we come from this inner city, right, to be able to kind of know the temperature without having to necessarily be right in the mix. So I feel like that does play a part in that. But like you also, I have to check myself and be like, they just young. They ain't what am I feeling anything or having to pay attention that much more. But it is a hell of a balance, I think, trying to navigate that one.
Yeah, but I think it speaks to the point that we always on in survival mode. Yes. You know what I mean? We always got to be on guard. When can we let our hair down, no matter what community? Yeah, I understand our community experiences definitely shape that. And so now, again, we're talking about where can we ever be in a place to just let our hair down and just exhale, right?
Yeah. With the negative interactions between police officers and civilians, do you think that impacts the amount of folks, black people who are pursuing careers in law enforcement?
Nah, not at all. Nah, because at the end of the day, man, it's about, again, we go back to the survival word. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to survive. You got to make a living. So if you're telling me that I can earn $50,000 straight out the gate by joining a Philadelphia Police Department, mm-hmm. and, you know, the longer I'm there, the more money I can make to feed my family, then why wouldn't I do that, right? Like this conflict that exists. You know, my neighbor, she right across, she's super fine. You know, I don't know why I say that on top, but you know, she's super fine. But when she put on, and she's, you know, late 30s, whenever she put on that uniform, my heart started beating fast, right? My old barber, he stopped being a barber so he could go into law enforcement. I see him now, again, it's all love, but he got that uniform on, my heart started beating fast, because it's not necessarily him, it's what he represents. Okay. It's that idea of, you know, like the Panthers talk about, no black man belongs in the white man's army, right? And so the more I become in tune with my blackness, the more I start to recognize that goes to the police department as well. People talk about, you know, the ubiquitous phrase of, you know, about there being is some good cops. It's just like, I don't even want to hear that. Why? Because the institution of police officers represents something that's extremely damaging to the black community, and which has caused irreparable harm for hundreds of years, right? And so I even when I hear about black folk, oh, they a good black person, they trying to do things within the police department, I find that, I'm not gonna say I find that hard to believe, but my thing is, you've either committed verbal or physical aggression towards a black person, right? You've either seen physical or verbal aggression towards a black person, or you've heard about one of your colleagues being physically or verbally aggressive towards a black person. What is your response to that, right? Are you calling into that? Are you telling your superior each and every time? Nah, probably not. Why? Because then the question is going to be, well, why are you here? If you can't adhere to this fraternity that is the Blue Shield, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, no, you're complicit too in your silence, right? Because you're not pulling people off of them. You're not saying, yo, don't talk to him like that. That's not necessary. Why? Because then you won't be the mark.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's, you damned if you do, damned if you don't. So again, I don't think it's going to stop anybody, because again, man, it's, you know, as long as you got You know, these, you know, as long as you got crime, as long as you got violence, as long as you got black folk, brown folk, you know, poor white folk that's out here, you need police officers, right? So, no, I don't think that would sway anybody.
Phil, how would you approach these topics, specifically, you know, racial tension and some of the other things we're facing? That's not just at the hands of police, but just systemic oppression. How would you approach that type of conversation with children, especially preteens?
That's interesting, man. You know, my daughter is 11, so I have a daughter who's 11. Her brother is 19. I've been around for more than half of his life. And so the answer is, I have no idea. I'm out here trying to roll the dice and try to figure it out myself. But, you know, as I try to, because it's the dilemma of not wanting to overexpose her, right, to different things. I want her to be an 11-year-old little girl, right? But then I also want her to know that, yo, it's some people who don't mean you well out here. There's some systems that are in place that won't allow you, they'll do everything in their power for you not to thrive. And so that's when we come in, you know, try to get her to read a black book, right, by a black author. She's like, no, I don't want to read that. I want to read this. And she don't understand that the importance of black authors, which a part of me says, yes, I'm glad you don't necessarily see race and ethnicity. But then it's just like, I need you to see race and ethnicity. You know what I mean? And so I look at myself as being, you know, I have to be the advocate for her. She goes to a Christian school, you know, which is majority Caucasian. Within the first 2 weeks, her teacher, Mr. Bateman, right? He says, you know, she doesn't have a humble spirit. And I'm like, wow. I had to take a step back. And so I was cool throughout the whole meeting because I always like to observe. But I'm like, nah, right? Because we understand the criminalization of black girls in private schools and what that looks like. And so maybe it's me being hypersensitive to you being an old white man who has Jesus hair and everything that's not Jesus, or, you know, any pushback that you might receive from a child because you're from a different school of thought is not appropriate. You know, I didn't want her in the room for that conversation, but a part of me did. And so it's just that balancing act and just trying to expose her, try to have conversations. She hears, you know, Megan Thee Stallion and Roddy Ricch, The Box. She just liked the song The Box, right? Or, you know, or Savage, she just liked the song. But I gotta, you know, remember, listen, she's hearing the music, but what's the messaging behind it? And so I got to do my job still of policing what it is that she's doing. I can only do so much, right? And so, but the one thing I did, which I think prepares her for when she does become of age, and I think Mr. Bateman saw it, because I think he said as much during the various meetings we had over the school year, is that she always has a response. And so when I hear that, I start smiling, exactly. Right, because it's this idea of, you know, the difference between poor folk and rich folk when it comes to, and it's in Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers book, and he said the affluent family, and we might even talk about monetarily, we're talking about, you know, just parenting, we're talking about so many other factors. When they're riding on a trip to the doctor, they say, well, what questions do you have for the doctor? Right, what are you going to ask him when he gets in there into these rooms? The little person asks him, so what are you going to do to me? What is that for? What is this for? What is that for? And so they're encouraged to ask as many questions. It's not be quiet because you're a child, stay in a child's place. It's no, you have agency over your person, over your body, as well. And so the family that's impoverished, in whatever way you want to look at it, right, it's no, this is the professional, this is the specialist, you listen to them. And so we can see our most outspoken parents, community members, but when they get in these rooms with these people with degrees, they're silent because we're taught to trust the expert. And so with my daughter, I never wanted to tell her because I said so. Sometimes I regret it, right? Because I just wanted to just do it. But it's just like, nah, man, because it's going to get to a time where somebody going to ask her to do something, and I don't want her to just comply. Yes. Because they have some letters behind their name. You know, so and I think that just goes to the whole piece of critical thinking, which is necessary when we talk about, you know, a child who turns into an adolescent, who turns into a young adult and adult.
I swear that whole piece could have been taken and applied to me. And like, that's wild. Like, I feel like I could have gave that same spiel. With that... In your opinion, which way has mental health wellness awareness benefited from social media?
I think at a basic level, people are acknowledging the idea of mental health as being something that exists, right? That I think when we talk about destigmatizing, people are able to say the words depression. They are able to say the words anxiety, despite me being in having a bachelor's in social work, getting a master's in social work. I still didn't feel comfortable in using the word depression and anxiety, just because, again, it wasn't part of my lexicon. But I see now that because it's being promoted so heavily on social media, people are using the terminology, which, you know, we know terminology matters. That's why, you know, people like, well, they're rioting. It's just like, nah, it's a rebellion, right? Terminology matters. And it might not mean much to somebody, but when we talk about understanding, once we start to get the terminology together, that helps us push the conversation further. And then it just allows people that idea of permission. You know, I think what you talked about when you're talking about, you know, raising little girls, it's like, nah, you know, I ain't got time to do X, Y, and Z, because nobody gave us the permission to say, yo, it's okay to cry, it's okay to feel this way. And so I think social media has given people permission to say, yo, I'm feeling this way. I look at the change between, you know, me being 35 and, you know, my son being 19. You know, God bless the dad. He was always tell me, they call me Jermaine. He's always say, go listen to XXX Tentacion. He talk about depression. I'm like, man, what am I? I don't want to listen to this young boy. Like, he ain't talking about nothing. And then the day he died, you know, I ended up writing an opinion piece on him. And, you know, so I'm listening to his music and I'm hearing him talking about depression and anxiety, and he's using the words. I'm like, yeah, he only 19, 20. And he used this, like, I wouldn't dare be able to use that at that age, even though that's what I was experiencing. So when we talk about, again, that permission being given, I think social media has done a lot to show that, yo, you're not in this alone. You know, there's other people out here who are on this, who are experiencing this as well.
Nailed it. The keywords of depression, anxiety, and thinking how I would hear those growing up, and I would never hear anyone in my circle, nobody's parents that I knew saying this. It was typically, you know, I went out to a predominantly white school from first through fifth grade. I feel like I would hear those words tossed out there on television shows, but never within the community. And seeing the older that I get, actually understanding how these things show up to where it's not just, oh, you're just scary. You're just, you know, he's always on edge. He's always mad about something, realizing what this actually is and putting that label and being okay, I guess, with identifying or having, you know, going and getting, going to a therapist and being able to talk through this stuff and getting the label handed so that you know that this isn't just my brain going crazy. This isn't me just being weird. This is actually something. And I think that now having that ability to be more accepting of it, I think there's still a lot of resistance to it overall, because I know even within myself of just throwing these words like, oh, I'm depressed, I'm
That's uncomfortable still. And I think there's still definitely more work, but I do agree that the socials have helped to kind of release some of the stigma.
Yeah.
Giving that vocabulary is super important because, you know, as you hear it more and more, even if you don't take the time to, you know, hit Google and get the true definition of these words being used, you gain the understanding through the experience.
Exactly.
And it also helps seeing people, like you say, Ken, that look like you using these words. Because up until, you know, very recently, I say within the last, you know, five to seven years, a lot of these things we just consider these are white people problems. What you talking about? Depression. What you mean you in bed depressed? You're being lazy, get up and go to work. You're being lazy, get up and handle your kids. What you mean depressed? I'm sad too. Like, you know, we really didn't understand what these things, you know, what these situations were. But again, you know, now that we have the vocabulary, it's extremely important that we use it and don't feel weird about using it. Don't feel like we're trying to be highbrow using, you know, these terms.
Exactly.
A lot of us, you know, we also come from that school. This is something common in every community, but Phil, I know you're very familiar with West Philly, 52nd Street.
Yeah.
Some of the brothers out there posting that, using every piece of vocabulary to convince you to buy either some oil or a mix. You know, it's been that way for me.
After they put the oil on you, you know what I mean?
After they put it on you. So with all this going on, what type of activities do you use to stay centered, bring yourself back down in, you know, in these tumultuous times?
We're talking about Corona and then we're talking about, you know, these events. So the last 2 months has been a complete shift for a lot of people just because, you know, a lot of the ways that we use to cope, we can't use them. So for me, it was going to Mark Lamont Hill's Uncle Bobby's Coffee Shop. I'm a full-time entrepreneur, so I will be in there Monday through Friday, right, for several hours at a time to just commune with other people because I needed that, right? I needed that opportunity just to have conversation, to have stimulating dialogue, to talk trash, to do, you know, X, Y, and Z within that environment. So now that's not there. The gym, like I'm somebody who's used gym since he was, you know, 300 pounds at 16 years of age. Well, 292, right? Because when you are certain, when you reach a certain number, you know what I mean? We don't want to get told the weight we not, right? So even if we round up, right, you know, I've used the gym as a method to help me cope. That was the first thing that I learned, healthy coping skills that I learned. I can't go to the gym. So what I had to do was I started running. I've been running now for the past like 2 or 3 years. I have periods off where I'm not running, but it was just like, yo, I got to get outside because these endorphins that come from exercise, that come from running, they have the same, they impact the same areas that medication do, right? So I take medication every day, Effexor 75 milligrams for depression and anxiety. I've been taking that now for the past 3 years, which has helped quell the suicidal ideations that I was experiencing for the last 15 years. But I know that's not all. That's going to be able to help me. I need to learn other skills, so I'll go out running. I post on social media. I hate social media with a passion, right? But it allows me, somebody who's thoughtful, who enjoys writing, to really write some thoughtful things to put them out into the universe. So I'm not keeping it inside. That's no different than somebody keeping a journal. And which is also things that people do. I just have trouble with keeping a journal, so I got to find other outlets. You know, trying to be around loved ones. You know, my partner, she moved in with me. That's a different experience all in itself. Again, another show for that. But you know, engaging with her more has been helpful. I have a daily digital show that I do Monday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Called Rhetorically Speaking. Check it out on YouTube. I do that. That's an opportunity for me to get my thoughts, feelings, and emotions out. For the last 18 months, I've been running a men's only wellness group called Hashtag You Good Man. At one point, we were doing it in person. Now we're doing it on Zoom virtually for anybody who identify as a man, as male, whether you're a trans man, a gay man, it doesn't matter. It's a space for you to have conversation and to emote. Again, that's helping me cope with not only what's happening and, you know, the traumas that we're seeing, but just with life in general, man. I always say that life is difficult. We just make it look easy on our day-to-day. Like, it's not easy, man. You know, we don't offer ourselves enough grace, enough compassion. We love on everybody else, but we don't love on ourselves, especially when we start talking about Black men, you know? So yeah, man, those are just some of the things that I do.
Okay. You know, all of us content creators, we've all got different platforms within the community and kind of, you know, our target market being the Black community. How do we as voices on platforms curated for the culture make sure that our communities know that we stand in solidarity with them?
I mean, continue to do the work that we do. You know, I had a brother who I made a post about the same thing I was talking about. Like in the fall, Philly schools are opening back up and we got asbestos, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, so tell me what the protest is going to be when you setting it up. I said, listen, I can talk about it, right? But I stay in my lane. Right, I know my lane. Like, it's a brother here, Gabriel Bryant, who's a part of some dope things in the city, right? Who's out marching. Shout out to Gabe. Right, that's his bag. I'm not saying that's not my bag, right, at some point, but I know my bag. I'm trying to hone my conversation, my discussion in the mental health space. And so what that means for me is, again, continue to be caught up on information, on literature, to be able to give to the community. Continuing to take care of myself, that's, you know, that's helping the community, right? So again, when we talk about just the messaging that we're putting towards the people, it's doing what we can to make sure we're providing compassionate information, caring information, science-based information, right? Like, not like, salute to the 5G people. I can't wait to get my 5G phone in a couple of years, right? But again, it's not participating in that, because again, when we start to do that, we start to it can cause more harm than good. It's being mindful of our voices, right? I know it's certain things that I might want to say, but I can't necessarily say it unless I can frame it in a way where it can be received, right? So it's being understand who's listening to you. I can't just go out and say everything that I want to say, right? Because again, it's just having that heightened self, that heightened level of self-awareness, which will then trickle down to the people who quote unquote follow you. But we all learning from one another, man, doing the best that we can.
Yeah, you're right. We're actively learning. And I remember being in the position in the state of mind where I was extremely upset with what I felt were Black celebrities and Black people who have attained the position of privilege not using their platforms. Mm. And then what happened was they started using their platforms, but they weren't well informed.
Yeah.
So then the whole thing backfired on me. I was like, no, please get a mic from in front of this man that I see in the booth. cut his mic off. Cut her mic off. They not in front of cameras. They don't have a script. This is going all bad.
So wait, you're not talking about quote unquote Raekwon, are you? What's his name? Shameik Moore, man. Listen,
shout out to Shameik Moore. So here's the thing. So when Shameik Moore said what he said, right? The very first thing that popped in my head was what Kendrick said and how everybody forgot Kendrick said it. So going back to the Mike Brown situation, Kendrick was one of the people that came out and was like, we need to take accountability for our own actions. Mm. There's footage of him in the convenience store. We need to talk about that and how we're interacting with cops and what was he doing before. And I was like, oh, man. And everyone forgot about that.
Yeah.
Everyone forgot about that. Not that we need to harp on it, because I feel as though the more information we are exposed to and the more we grow, we don't need to hold you to some of those, you know, past ways of thinking. But the method that you described earlier with regards to recognizing the people that are already on the ground, I think that's the key. That's what I want these celebrities to do.
Yeah.
I don't need Puff holding symposiums with other rappers.
Yeah.
No. Get the people. If you want to have a conversation about criminal justice reform, Puff, get the people that are actively on the forefront. Elevate them on your platform, and you don't even moderate. You get out the way.
Yeah.
Get out the way and let the most informed people have these conversations.
That's
you know.
And no, you make a great point, because, you know, when I think about Shameik Moore, like, yeah, you laugh a little bit, right? Same thing with, well, Hill Harcourt didn't laugh. Right? Like, he definitely got castigated when he made the comment about the Gab Union and D-Wade's daughter by, you know, misgendering him. I came at his neck.
What did Hill Harper say?
Oh, you missed that.
Completely.
So it was Zaya's birthday, and, you know, Gab put this post up, and Hill Harper said, happy birthday, young man. Your mom contributed to my book, you know, the book about letters, Dear Black, something like that, with the black boys or what have you. You could learn something from it and benefit from it. And,
wow.
And yeah, people let them have it, and rightfully so. I made a post about it, and, you know, but then I made the post because that was my initial knee-jerk reaction, which, again, I'm human. And then I had to take a step back, and I always use this quote from Day Day, man. It was just like, yo, players F up. You know what I mean? Players F up. Like, if you have this moment, so I look at Shameik Moore, just like, yo, players F up, right? And so we gotta extend that grace. And Mark commented, Mark Mahill commented on my post, like, you know, I consider him a friend. I talked to him, you know, and he was, you know, contrite about it. It's like, hey, I can't hold that against you, right? Just because black folk not in the position to just be canceling folk. Unless you Bill Cosby, unless you R. Kelly, and you committed, you know, heinous acts against the community, and even then, I'm a social worker, so I still believe in one's propensity to change. And so I think we got to start really start extending people grace. So even though Shameik Moore, you know, might get the donkey of the day, it's still like, all right, young fella. All right, now we laughed at you for a minute. Now how can we inform you? Right. And so that's why I look at people like Charlamagne. Like, Charlamagne, not in my top five people of all time, but I look at him, you know, with this mental health conversation. I know he talks about anxiety, but he goes and gets people like Taz and Black Men Heal and have them on his show. He gets, you know, regular people, the lay people, to come on his show, even if it's for 15, 20 minutes, to have his conversation. So I got to, you know, salute him for that, even though it's some other things that he needs to be held accountable for, like not pushing back against Biden right in that moment. But again, like you say, who we proclaiming as the voice, or who's proclaiming themselves as the voice? Because, you know, we equating knowledge and experience to money. And so that, and how much income you generate, you know what I'm saying? So, no, I get your point wholeheartedly.
Yeah, and it's so funny that you brought up Hill Harper, because I recently, and I'm the last one to the table on this, apparently, I recently found out that Isaiah Washington is an avid Trump supporter, MAGA for life type dude. And when I was doing my research, I came across an article where Hill Harper is discussing it, saying, you know, I've known a brother for many years, but, you know, I didn't see this coming. And he critiques him, and here it is. You're giving me another situation where he is being homophobic, transphobic. It's interesting how we miss the intersectionality of oppression with these different communities. It's really interesting how that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is.
It's funny with the Isaiah Washington. I just seen a brother. He just, and we're not Facebook friends. I know him through other people. And he's blackety black, you know what I mean? Like, he's when we talk about complexion, and he was sitting defending, you know, talking about Trump and the statistics related to employment. And he went to Martin Luther King High School here in Philadelphia, played football. And it replays the idea in my mind, you know, with Denzel, with Malcolm X, like, what's the matter, boss? We sick? And that's what I get from Isaiah Washington, like, yo, we sick. And it's like, I look at it, it's like, yo, yeah, it's, you know, we can't say it's a diagnosable mental health condition, your lack of blackness, but, you know, informally we're going to say that, you know, so, right. Yeah.
What do you think are some good places to start in gaining an understanding of what other marginalized communities within the Black community might be experiencing?
Listen, Google, man. Like, everything is Googleable. Yes. You know, you can literally type in, like, what are Black trans people experiencing? And it's going to come up. What are Black trans people experiencing? And give you a list of you know, first person accounts of that experience. There's talking to people. That's the realest thing that you can do. But unfortunately, where we are as a society, we've become so individualistic that we don't know how to communicate with one another. And that's coming from somebody who finds difficulty in having conversations with Black men. Because again, hip hop told me otherwise, like, yo, you my competitor. I can't sit and smile at you when I'm walking down the street. I got a grit on my face, right? I can't understand your experience because you're a threat to me. Again, having those conversations with Black women, like, again, I'm stepping into my Blackness, and what that constitutes is me having people who are going to truly hold me accountable. So I got, you know, people like Okosua, people like Jazz Riley, people like Stephanie, both Stephanies, who, if I say something out of pocket, or I say something that's a little, you know, off the cuff, not appropriate, they'll say, yo, like, what's up with you? Mm. It's just like, no, all right, first for me, you want to say what's up to with me, I'm going to automatically catch offense to it,
yeah.
Right? Because I know me. But now me understanding me and having self-awareness, I could take a step back and start to reflect. So a lot of times we get defensive and we shut off from everybody. I'll admit I get defensive, but then I'll take a moment, you know, and say, hold up, what's going on? What are they talking about? Right? Let me self-reflect. And that's where, again, we got to adopt these skills. But it's hard to have an awareness and an understanding of others if for so long you've been told not to have awareness of self in who you are. So it makes that much more difficult, because you, like, if nobody cares about me, why should I care about anybody else, right? If nobody, that's what people don't understand about this quote-unquote looting, right? Like, yo, you haven't cared about me and my family and my family's family and my parents' parents' parents for X amount of years. Why should I care if somebody running in Macy's, right? Right. I think the statute of limitation passed. I used to steal from Walmart when I was in college. I go, you know, just go get me some BBBs and some white tees and 3XL white tees. It's like, hey. You know, it's like, why should I care about Walmart when they done killed the mom and pop store? You know, when they done did X, Y, and Z. So if I can't relate it to my direct experience, why should I care? And studies show, when we talk about men in particular, and not just Black men, in order for us to truly empathize, you have to relate the situation to us, right? So remember when you felt that way? Yeah, that's how they're feeling. And so that allows us to take a step back. But otherwise, it can be difficult. But yeah, Google, having conversations with people, and reading. You know, as Baldwin who said, you think you got, you're the only one with problems out here, you know, I'm summarizing. You think you're the only one with problems out here until you read, right? Then you read and you're like, oh, dang, that was happening over in Asia. Dang, that was happening in Africa. That was happening in the West Indies. Oh, yeah, it's a lot going on out here. So, yeah.
Do you think, you brought up the looting. What's being classified as the looting. I'm going to call it looting in this particular scenario, not necessarily in reference to what it's happening right now with the current rebellion and uprising. But do you think what is being considered as looting changes the relationship that these corporations have with the community? Because I feel like up until now, with the infrequency of it, there was no direct way for us to say to these corporations, hey, there are consequences for being in our community irresponsibly. There are consequences for being in our community and not being engaged in the conversation. I saw a post from Reebok on their Instagram, a 3-slide post with them speaking to Black Lives Mattering, getting out in front of it. HBO did the exact same thing. These things weren't happening as frequently as before.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, like, with Target to be in these communities, just speaking of Portland specifically, Ken, listen, they ran up in the Nike store. They ran up in the Apple store. Like, we saw footage of that. And we are avid Apple purchasers. We're all things Apple around here.
Yeah.
Ken and myself. So when I saw them run up in the Apple store, I was like,
look,
it was so crazy. And my partner had to be like, chill. I was, for a split second, I was appalled. I was like, oh my God, they're going to, it's like they broke into a family member's house. And I was like, they're in our store. What's happening? We need the genius. Why is no one at the Genius Bar? What is this is outrageous. Yeah. Why didn't they beef up
Black
security?
Air Force One energy was strong that
night. It was.
And that's when I talk about what I say. That's when that inner Karen come out. You know what I mean? That inner Karen popped out like, oh my gosh, wait, what are you doing? But I made a post on Facebook and Instagram about it. I was like, you know what I mean? People mad at Luton until that person like, yo, I got that iPhone 11 for $100 for you. Then you like, you know, we talking about those moral dilemmas that pop up. You know what I'm saying?
Oh my God.
It's interesting when we talk about this idea of looting. First, for people, everybody would participate in looting, right? And it just comes down to this idea of social conditioning, right? And social psychology. Everybody has a different threshold. So you might not be the first person to run up in the store and grab something or to hit a police car. But if you see 20,000 people, you might be 20,001. If you see 100,000 people, you might be 100,001. And so, you know, it's this, and, you know, I got that idea from Malcolm Gladwell, who got the idea from another researcher, because everybody has a different threshold when it comes to things, right? You might not necessarily be the first person to go buy a pair of slim jeans. It took me 10 years to go buy a pair of skinny jeans. And now I'm like, dude, this is what I've been missing. I could bend over and put my sneaker because it's stretched. Like, what?
Right. Hit him with that stretch. That's technology, man.
You know, it's like, but again, you couldn't be the first person to do it, but now here we are, right? So again, we got to be mindful about the very thing that we're condemning, because we don't want to be the very thing that we're condemning, which is oppression and what have you. I mean, as far as looting, as far as, you know, what corporations are doing, man, it's all about the bottom line. You know, when that whole thing came down with Kaepernick and Nike supporting them, they recognized that it could be helpful for the bottom line when they did that whole promotion, because he was sitting there dormant for a minute with Nike until they could figure out what to do with them. Yeah, I saw the Louis Vuitton, I think it was the Louis Vuitton store, the Gucci store, one of them in Atlanta getting looted. They just going to, you know, fix it up. Right, because they know the dollar is still going to come. What they might do, they might, you know, bring in a Dapper Dan as a brand strategist, right? As a face, but ultimately, nah. Do I believe the dollars are going to trickle in for whatever reason? Now you just want to have that illusion that you're present and you're a part of the struggle, like we do with white folk, man. Like, I'm sitting there, you know, seeing everybody, oh, the silence of your friend, you know, white folk, whatever, you know, the Martin Luther King quote, tell you a whole lot. I'm like, So wait, what y'all want them to do? Y'all want them to just post on social media? Like, I could care less about that. Like, that's just a statement. Like, show me what your protest is going to be. If you're a white teacher and you get back into these black and brown schools and the asbestos is there and the books are there, what is your protest going to look like 6 months from now and a year from now? That's what I'm worried about. You know, that's what I'm concerned about. Not that you're saying, oh my gosh, George Floyd shouldn't have been killed. I'm cool on that. Like, we can all agree to that. Even the most, you know, the volatile of people. Shucks, the police agreed to that, right? So, yeah, let me see what your protest is going to look like. And so, again, that goes to Nike, that goes to Apple, that goes to all these places, right? And so yeah, I'm not optimistic. I'm not optimistic. You know, I don't look for justice. I had to sit on that. I was on a panel with, you know, with a few amazing people like Damian Young and Kaese Lehman and Brittany Cooper. And the moderator asked us, what does justice look like? And after I sat there, I said, it can be no justice, right? We talking about hundreds and hundreds of years of irreparable harm done to a community. Mm-hmm. Like the effects of what's happening to George Floyd, what happened to George Floyd is going to impact generations to come. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's no justice. All we're talking about is some semblance of accountability, which has been lacking the 19 years that this officer was on the force and had 12 complaints against them, you know, where accountability wasn't had. So what we're looking for is just some accountability, because we know that it's going to happen again. That's why, you know, people outrage, that's cool, but, you know, save some of that energy for the next person it's going to happen to, because it probably just happened 10 minutes ago, but we're not going to get wind of it until July. You know what I'm saying? So,
you know, I think about how often the idea of like your stoic man, right? Stoic woman, you're strong, and what strength means, or at least what I thought strength meant for a long time, which was being able to handle whatever's thrown out and be able to always be there in full form and fashion. And I'm learning now in my mid-30s, yeah, it don't work like that for forever, yeah. Right? Yeah. What advice do you have for people who have been the strong friend or family member for as long as they can remember and may have forgot or never even learned how to focus on their need to offload their pain and frustration?
Well, first, you know, I'm not a fan of the strong friend, right? Like, shout out to Royce da 5'9". That album was amazing. You know, and I heard the, you know, the check up on your strong friend. And I'm like, you know, because words matter, right? Like, I'm a firm believer words matter. That's why you'll never hear me say I suffer from mental illness. I live with mental illness because suffering has a negative connotation attached to it. And I'm not suffering at all. Yeah, I have my moments at times, and sometimes it persists longer than I desire. But no, I'm not suffering. As long as I have breath, I'm still living, right? And so when we talk about the strong friend, conversely, we're strong, weak. Right. So the people who are speaking out, the people who are coming to somebody with their problems, are we saying that they're somehow weak? The people who die by suicide, again, language matters. They don't commit suicide because commit has a negative connotation to it. They die by suicide because they seek something greater in the next life that they can't feel, that they feel they can't find here. Again, words matter. And so when we talk about, you know, this quote unquote strong friend, I'm looking at about an individual who's yet to find the healthy coping strategies to be, or find the environment safe enough, or somebody who hasn't been given the permission to express themselves, to get out those thoughts, feelings, emotions. So I'm a firm believer in therapy, man. I'm a firm believer. I think every black person in the world needs to see a therapist. Because again, you come out the womb on this ice and you slipping and sliding. And the older you get, the more you start, you know, your footing becomes more and more slippery. And so I'm a firm believer in seeing a therapist. You know, if they're black, is that cool? For sure. Mm-hmm. But seeing somebody is seeing somebody, and there's a whole process that comes with that, right? Also saying no. I'm a firm believer in saying no. Sometimes I look at my phone, oh, so-and-so calling? Word. All right, let me go back to this Call of Duty. You know what I mean? you can't be accessible all the time.
Yeah.
Right? You can't. Just no matter whether it's at any point, like this whole Zoom period we're experiencing. Like, you know, if I'm my partner, she's on the phone, you know, doing work. I'm like, dang, you don't work like a 10-hour work day. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yo, turn that joint off. It's the weekend. Turn it off. They're going to be all right. Yeah. Right. And if something goes down and it's urgent, then call 911. That's what they're there for. You know what I mean? And so now you got to have boundaries. It's important that you establish boundaries. And the first part is start by saying no. And you should do it, again, unapologetically. Right? You should be unapologetic about taking care of yourself. Find different ways to find healthy ways to cope. Find ways to challenge yourself. You know, whether it's playing Sudoku on a daily basis, or just finding a way to get that frustration out. I was on a call, a wellness call on Friday, and they're like, oh, you playing the game again? Yes, I am. I am playing Call of Duty. Would you like to see? Why? Because it's better for me to shoot people on here, get that anger and aggression out here, than go out in the world and express that anger and aggression, because it's understood in here, but outside it's not. So, yeah, you know, again, you know, and trust people. That's a lot of things. A lot of times, you know, people who are that go-to person, people trust them, but they don't trust people. Right. And so we're talking about, again, this doesn't just start when you're 25, when you're 30, when you're 50. This starts way early. We all learn how to cope.
Yeah.
Right. When and for those who might follow me after this, you'll hear me talk about, I learned how to cope when my brother died from an opioid overdose when I was 17, and I got a rest in peace tattoo thinking that was going to do something to help me with the pain. And I went to school 2 days later and cursed the computer teacher out. First, who curses at the computer teacher? That's the one class you want to go to, because all you're doing is Mavis Beacon. You know what I mean? And so, again, why did I curse her out? Because my mama could curse somebody out with the best of them. So I learned how to cope from people. Right. You learn how to cope from what it is that you see. And so when you're that person, that go-to person, somebody in your life was that go-to person, and you learned and adopted that skill set. And so now it's to offer yourself permission to say, you know what, it's okay. My third and final therapist, they say it takes 10 years for somebody to get their mental health, quote unquote, under control. The first therapist I went to was a black woman. She was awful, right? Because she started talking to me about her clients. The second therapist I went to was about 7 years later. She was a white woman. Oh, Phil, I'm sorry to hear that. And I'm like, nah, I gotta be manipulative with you. I need somebody to hold me accountable. My third therapist that I went to, Dr. Val, she was like, you know, I walked in and I just burst into tears. And at the end of it, she was like, so you think you won't come back? And I was like, yeah, you know, my daughter could benefit from it. My daughter's mother could benefit from it. If I get my next partner, they could benefit from it. My job as an entrepreneur. She said, well, what about you? What you mean, what about me? Right? Nah, me. You know, and it's just like, exactly. What about me? What about Phil? This is about me, right? Like, this is my life. I got to be selfish with my energy. I got to be selfish with my time. Because, again, if I die, this world going to keep on rolling. If you die, somebody going to fill your seat at work. You know, I've literally seen that happen. You know what I mean? Like, somebody had a heart attack and they put somebody right in that seat about a month later. So you're expendable in every area of your life. And so you don't want to be expendable to yourself. So again, treat yourself with that utmost care and compassion. But again, you didn't just get here from this day. I know I don't want to just keep talking, but Jennifer Lewis, you know, the actress, she's so amazing. When she was on The Breakfast Club, she was like, you know, she was experiencing bipolar. You know, she finally started getting therapy in like her late 20s, early 30s. And she was like, I recognize that it took me 30 years to get here. So now it might take me 30 to 40 years to really start to undo all of this damage that I've done to myself. And that's been done, that I've allowed to be done to me. That's another thing. Forgive yourself. Right? Forgiving yourself is super hard. We allow things to happen to us. Why? Because we don't know any better, or because of trauma, or because of so many things. We got to forgive ourselves. You know, whether it's talking about infidelity, you know, forgive yourself. Don't bring that to the next relationship. And then you start to seek out perfection. That's no different than cheating, right? Because again, you're so focused on not being your true authentic self. So I know I said a lot, man, but again, permission, therapy, saying no, these are just a little of the things that you can do.
Yo, one of the things you said about how, you know, being that strong family member or that strong friend, I really related to as far as not being able to trust people. And a lot of that came from the way I played that strong friend and the way I continue to play that strong family member is from doing a lot of listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as I'm hearing a lot of my friends, you know, experiences and some of the things that I felt like, okay, you definitely could have avoided that. It did cause me to trust people less for the simple fact that anyone is capable of anything.
Yeah.
You know? So in order for me to trust you, I have to know who you are first, and then I can trust what you will or won't do in a particular situation.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely from the rip, I was like, oh, yeah, no. He spit. In your conversations, coaching sessions with black men specifically, what are some of the reoccurring themes or issues?
You know, a lot of what I see is, again, that safe space. A lot of them don't feel that they have the space is safe enough for them to you know, say what they feel. I always use the example of, you know, a black man out in the world and his girlfriend is getting on his nerves. And so he says, yo, this bee is getting on my nerves. The world will look at him like, oh my gosh, you called her a bee. Just like no different than the focus that's shifting, we focusing on the looting, right? Right. Where we lose focus of what he's saying because he didn't say it in a way that was appropriate, quote unquote, appropriate, and then politically correct, that was acceptable. And so my thing is, yeah, I want to understand first and foremost what is happening within your relationship. Then I want to address, you know, what it is, why it is that you feel comfortable in using this derogatory term, right? If she deems it to be derogatory. Right. And so it's those themes. It's a lot of brothers who are like, yo, I'm now in my late 20s, early 30s, and I don't want to be hanging around my friends who talk about sneakers and music all the time. Like, that's cool, but I want to have some deeper conversations. Right. I want to truly explore those innermost feelings that I've had and possessed, because either they're not serving me well. I'm tired of being angry. Like, we look at the angry black man. You know what I mean, man? Sit your down. Like, we look at him and we laughing, but yo, it's exhausting. Folks get tired of that, and brothers get tired of that, but they don't have any other coping skills to deal with it. It might be an acute traumatic situation that might have happened. You know, working with a young brother who he swore he was going D1, right? He's now 20. Swore he was going D1. The offers didn't come in, right? And so then he had to go D2. He went D1, but he had to be a walk-on. And then he was on the scout team, right? And he was the man throughout high school. And now here he is, and he's on scout team for 2 years. And now he's the only thing that gave him a validity in his life. Now he's being... He doesn't have that anymore. And so now he's looking around like, wait, who am I? Because a lot of times we get so caught up in with identity issues, right? Because we're known for the one thing that we do best, right? So for me, it might be, I'm the mental health boy. That's what people, yo, that's the mental health guy. It's like, nah, I'm just born in this bar trying to have a beer right now. You know what I mean? But we start to over-identify with our roles so much that we forget, yo, I'm the person who likes to go running. I like weightlifting. I'm the person who likes reading books. But again, we become so hyper-focused. And then when it's not there anymore, we start looking around like, who am I? We see this a lot with our athletes, right? If you're not one of the ones who get immediately into broadcasting, you're left twiddling your thumbs. And we see them go broke because, again, all you knew was athletics. That's been your life for 25 years. Now people are saying, well, yeah, who are you outside of that? And you have no idea. So I see a lot of, especially a lot of brothers trying to figure out who they are and their role in society. That's really the biggest theme, and just trying to find alternative ways of coping.
Okay. So in your TED talk, you spoke about going from living to thriving. Can you speak more about that for our listeners?
Yeah, man. It's, you know, it's just that idea. I want to have more moments where I'm smiling, right? I always talk about people like, Phil, are you happy? My mom asked me that. She's like, Phil, are you happy? I'd be like, I don't have a desire to be happy, right? Like, that's not real. My desire is to be able to truly experience all of the emotions while I'm in them. Right. So if I'm angry, I want to be able to experience anger. Anger is a healthy emotion. Being frustrated is healthy. Being sad is healthy. Fear is healthy. But conversely, I also want to smile more. I want to be experience those happy moments. I don't want to just emotionally just be, again, that stoic word. I don't just want to be able to say, not get too high, not get too low. What kind of life is that? Yes. I want to be able to experience every emotion in a healthy way. So when I'm happy, I want to be in that moment. When I'm angry, I want to be in that moment and not suppress those feelings, but be able to manage them and allow them the opportunity to go through whatever it is that they're going through. Speaking of my mama, she dialing me right now. But again, it's this idea of, I want to put myself in a position where I am thriving, whether it's employment. I haven't had a full-time job since I worked for the city of Philadelphia when I was 26. I realized that, you know, I saw what was happening and how black, it was a war on poverty and a war on black and brown folks. In child welfare, I couldn't take nobody else's kids, man, just because you ain't had no water, right? Nobody cared about the circumstances, and we know that when black and brown kids get into foster care, it takes them twice as long to get out, and it didn't sit well with me. And so I just one day say, listen, yeah, I'm resigning. And she said, you don't want to give 2 weeks notice? I said, if I end up back here, that means something in my life went wrong. Right. Did I have a steady paycheck for 2 weeks after that? Did I have a job immediately after that? No, but I believed in myself. And it was truly for me, I steady deal with the imposter syndrome that so many of us deal with. And so I know my skill set is thorough. Right. Like, even in the midst of this, like, I'm like, yo, Phil, you killing this joint. But a part of me is like, Phil, you stinking it up right now. And so I battle that on a daily basis. So for me, thriving is continue to prove myself wrong. Right. And continue and prove myself right in the moments where I know that I have a dope skill set. I want to be able to get into the arenas that I desire to be in. And so for me, that's thriving. But I just want peace. Right. At the end of the day, man, for me, it starts with this inner peace that I can't get from external circumstances. And once I have that peace, I'm thriving. And then anything that comes my way is just adding on to that happiness. It's like relationships, man. Like, this is my first healthy relationship at 35. Mm. You know, from my mentor, he's Alfred Edmonds, he's the senior vice president at Black Enterprise. Mm. He got his first healthy relationship at the age of 48, mm. right? Because he said, yo, I need to be happy. I need to be comfortable with myself. And then whoever comes, they add on. I'm not looking for nobody to help make me happy, right? That's something that a lot of us who might lack love in any capacity, that's one thing we start to look to. Yeah, man. So for me, thriving is, again, putting myself in a position where I'm just making healthy decisions for myself, for those I love, and going forward.
As we close, Phil, first, you know, thank you for your time. This has been amazing. Yes. I can't wait, you know, for our listeners to be able to check this interview out. No. Can you tell us a little bit about Quadify and how people can learn more?
So Quadify, because I did a lot of talking, but Quadify is just the idea, man, of helping any and everybody, whether it's people, whether it's businesses that I consult with. I do a lot of professional developments for, you know, for elementary schools, high schools. A lot of what I do with Quadify is speaking at different colleges, which is difficult because now everybody's shut down. But again, spreading this information of total wellness. I'm about 130,000 in student loan debt. I got a bachelor's and master's in social work. I have a master's in exercise science. And I'm pursuing a doctorate in social work. It's starting in August. Hey. And so, again, it's about this idea of total wellness. Because, again, if you, there's a deficit in one area, then there's more than likely going to be the deficit in another area. And our goal is to live optimally. So we need all of those aspects of self to be firing. And so those avenues, whether it's coaching, whether it's speaking, you know, whether, again, physical wellness coaching, body comp coaching, I coach athletes as well as do mental health wellness coaching. And so, yeah, that's what Quadify is, man. It's just helping people get into a position to where they recognize their strengths, because that's what it is. Like, you the expert of your own life. I'm just here to help guide you, right? But you got all the answers within you. But it's a make, you know, it's just a matter of self-confidence and a matter of certain other things that to help you with, to put you in a position to where you see that you're, at the end of the day, that you're worthy. You know, for people who are interested in following up with me, www.quadify, that's Q as in quail, U-A, D as in dog, E-F-Y, LLC.net. You can hit me up on Instagram, Phil_Roundtree. You can shoot me a message. I'm not bougie. You know, I hit you back. You know, people ask me questions all the time, and it's just like, oh, I'm just going to give you some information, because that's the end of the day, man. That's what this is, man. We need to spread information, and that's another form of love when we do spread this information to our people, because as we can see, if I don't do it, if y'all don't do it, then who going to do it? You know what I'm saying? So
I want to give you GOAT status right quick for using quail. As because as you said it, I thought about it, and I was like, I don't think I've ever heard someone give a cue and then have to follow up with the word to that. Was great. I just
no, you know what it is, man. It's that what's that freaking not above the rim? Wesleyan and
White Man Can't Jump.
Yeah, you know, food that's not with the letter Q, which you go to Jeopardy. So I always think about that when I start.
That's awesome. Yeah, this was a great conversation, man. Great.
No doubt.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much.
And shout out to, you know, it's another therapist. He actually lives in Portland. His name is Christopher Scott. A brother out there who doing dope things. He got a master's in social work too. Catch him on Instagram at Hip Hop Social Worker. He got a podcast by the same name. Again, a dope brother, man. He always show me love. He always reposting me, so I got to make sure I do the same. He's a resource out there. He's a gem out there. You know, we always talk about, you know, I want to trade CJ McCollum for Ben Simmons. You know what I mean? Like, we always had those conversations. So shout out to Chris, man.
Righteous.
Oh yeah, we're definitely gonna reach out to Chris then. Thanks for putting that on the radar.
Real quick, before we wrap up, I'm sorry. I also got to, because I'm bad at self promotion. Also, again, I got Rhetorically Speaking. That's Monday through Thursday at 7 p.m. is live. I take phone calls. I do Skypes as long as your hair done. again, you can catch that on YouTube. That's Quadify LLC. I also have the hashtag You Good Man podcast, which is on all live streaming platforms. Again, it's men coming together to talk about men's issue. The last episode, I had some great creatives on: Kaise Lehman, Derek Harriel, Zane, who's a professional dancer, Alati Farmer, who's a writer. And again, just bringing information to men. Also have the hashtag You Good Man Men's Wellness Group. Now we're meeting bi-weekly on Zoom. And so again, you can see all that on my Instagram at Phil_Roundtree. Again, you know, if I got time and I got energy, continue to put out things to just help people, man. Cause at the end of the day, man, we all we got.
talk about. Thanks so much.
No doubt.
Thank you so much. Everybody, make sure you hit those links. We will make sure we have links to everything Phil's talking about in the description. Make sure you head on over to thenumbers.fm for the full interview, because we'll be able to post this entire thing. Man, but this was great, man. Thank you so much, bro. And for those just tuning in, that was our interview with Philip Roundtree of Quadify LLC, discussing our community's relationship with mental health. Make sure you all check in with us every Monday at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 8 p.m. as we sit down and run up the numbers. You can also find us on X-Ray FM 107.1 at 6 a.m. on Mondays.
Run Up the Numbers, hosted by Cam Jones and DJ Ambush. This episode also features Philip Roundtree. Special thanks to our researchers and writers, Shireen Hassan, Sham Shawan, Hannah, Alicia, and Joseph Watson. Music by C.
Boom.